Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Happening now, breaking news. Divided Democrats appear ready to scrap a cornerstone of the Biden agenda, dropping paid leave. That's part of their desperate scramble to reach a deal in the coming hours before the president heads overseas. We're following the 11th hour wrangling, the chaos, and the uncertainty. Also tonight, a new subpoena is in the works for a key January 6th witness, the Trump lawyer who tried to convince Vice President Pence he could overturn the election. This, as President Trump has found a surprising new platform to spread the big lie. And a chilling admission in the fatal movie set shooting. The assistant director telling authorities that he failed to fully check Alec Baldwin's gun before he handed it to the actor. How and why was it loaded with live ammunition? We want to welcome our viewers here in the United States and around the world. I'm Wolf Blitzer. You're in the Situation Room.
This is CNN Breaking News.
We begin with the breaking news on the latest Hail Mary by the Democrats in their frantic and so far failed efforts to reach a deal to advance the president's agenda. Let's go right to our White House correspondent, Arlette Sines. Arlette, there is a real sense of urgency by the White House to reach a deal before the president departs for overseas tomorrow morning. But tonight, we're learning about another major concession to the president's spending package. Give us all the late-breaking developments.
Well, Wolf, this is a very big deal. Paid family and medical leave was a key plank of President Biden's economic agenda, and it now appears likely that it will not be included in the plan. The Democrats had originally hoped for 12 weeks of paid family leave, but then last week in our own CNN town hall, President Biden said that had been whittled down to 4 weeks, and now sources have said it is likely out of the plan completely. And what appears to be a concession to Senator Joe Manchin, who had expressed some concerns about that proposal. Now, this comes as Democrats are scrambling to put together and hammer out the final details of this plan. And President Biden and his top negotiators here at the White House have really zeroed in on those two key holdout senators, Senator Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, meeting with both of them over the course of the past 24 hours to listen to their concerns. But also at the same time, the White House is still talking to those progressives. Case in point, Senator Bernie Sanders was here at the White House this afternoon meeting with President Biden for a little over an hour. He said that it was a good discussion, but he ultimately does not believe a deal will be reached this evening. Now, as these details are still being negotiated, House Democratic leaders are hoping to potentially hold a vote on that bipartisan infrastructure as soon as tomorrow. But progressives are still insisting that they want to see that bipartisan plan tied with a larger economic package. Take a listen.
I don't think the Speaker has ever brought a bill to the floor that doesn't have the votes. And right now, there are over three dozen members, and that number is only increasing, who feel very strongly that these two bills need to move together.
And the President can convince you to change your mind.
I don't think so.
Now, even as there are still more details to be worked out, one of those involves how exactly to pay for this plan. There has been some coalescing among Democrats about that corporate minimum tax, a 15% tax on those companies with profits over $1 billion. But that billionaire tax for individuals still appears to be up in the air. So many things still needing to be ironed out in order to reach an agreement. Tomorrow, the House Democratic Caucus has set a meeting for 9 a.m., which could be a key test for the fate of the president's agenda.
Arlette Sines at the White House for us. Arlette, thank you very much. Let's get some more on all of this. Joining us now, our chief political correspondent, Dana Bash, our congressional correspondent, Lauren Fox, and CNN political analyst, Maggie Haberman, the Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Dana, paid family leave is certainly a cornerstone of the president's overall domestic agenda. How big of a blow is this if this is out, completely out of the plan?
It's a huge blow. You are going to see as the dust begins to settle and as Democrats start to kind of get their messaging across, that you're going to start to hear them talk about the yeah, but yeah, there are a lot of other things that they hope will still be in this very large package that they are going to tout, which is legitimate. But the reality is that that will mask the very real disappointment that something that is wildly popular among the Democratic base and more broadly beyond the Democratic base, that almost everybody on the campaign trail running for president for the Democratic nomination, running for Congress in the House and the Senate, say that they want it in some way, shape or form. And it is no longer in the cornerstone of what the president was hoping would be a real change, a sea change in the way things like paid family leave are approached in America.
You know, Maggie, I want you to watch how passionately President Biden spoke about this issue at CNN's town hall just last week. Listen.
How much time off would parents actually get under your proposal? Because at one point you talked about 12 weeks. Now there's reports it's down to maybe 4 weeks.
Yeah, it is down to 4 weeks. And the reason it's down to 4 weeks, they can't get 12 weeks. And but look, here's the deal, guys. How many people do you know, not a joke, or maybe yourself, have had a circumstance where you are working like a devil, you're making $7 an hour, $15 an hour, $20 an hour, and you have a child that's sick at home, or you have a mother or father, husband or wife, son or daughter, and you need to stay home to help them? We're one of the few industrial countries in the world that does not have paid leave.
So, Maggie, how hard is it going to be for Democrats to accept the idea that paid family leave is being cut?
This is going to be difficult, Wolf. I just want to add to what Dana was saying. This isn't just popular among the Democratic base, and certainly we saw Democrats campaigning for it extensively during the presidential race, but this is broadly popular, paid family leave, and we have seen this in one poll after another over the last several years. So this is going to be disappointing to a number of people. There will be independent voters who are also going to be disappointed to see a key cornerstone of Joe Biden's plan come out. It will be hard for Democrats to accept. It will be frustrating for them to accept. You are going to see, I think, a lot more frustration, particularly about Senator Manchin, who at the moment has been very successful in trying to push back elements of this plan that he objects to, despite the fact that it has more support more broadly in the Democratic caucus. This is not going to go down easily. But again, I just am stressing this because this is going to be really critical, or would have been really critical, to millions of families. And it is not just Democratic lawmakers who are going to be upset. It's going to be voters.
Yeah, it seems, Lauren, like Democrats are gutting these key issues to try and simply get Senators Manchin and Sinema on board. What's the latest? What are you hearing up on Capitol Hill?
Well, trying to attract both Senators Manchin and Sinema to support this bill has been the ballgame from the beginning. And it's become clear that it's exasperated a lot of progressives who have told us as soon as today that they feel like this entire negotiation is moving to the center, to a more moderate position, only because they have two members, sometimes just one member. In the case of that billionaire's tax, it's Senator Joe Manchin, who doesn't support it. And that is becoming infuriating. You've heard Senator Bernie Sanders, the chairman of the Budget Committee, say multiple times today that he thinks it is crazy that the entire Democratic Senate is together on most of this proposal, except for one or two members, and therefore they continue to just have to change and water down this bill. We should note, however, that there's really no recourse for the Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who has to hold his entire caucus together to try to get Manchin or Sinema in line. Yes, they can try to convince them. Yes, they can try behind the scenes to work these negotiations. They have been. They've been doing that at every turn. Obviously, the president has been involved here, but that doesn't necessarily change the calculation of the fact that Manchin won in a state that President Trump also won. And that is a very real calculation for someone like Manchin.
You know, Dana, both sides of the Democratic Party, the progressives, the moderates, seem to have thought the other side would compromise when this finally came down to the wire. Did they miscalculate?
I don't necessarily think so, because both sides have compromised. But Lauren is exactly right. And you see her up there. She walks the halls and talks to these progressives every turn that she makes. And the progressives very much feel like they compromised a lot more than Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema on a whole host of issues, the most vivid And the most stark example is what we learned tonight, which is paid family leave being gone. But there are lots of other things. I mean, just the idea of community college, tuition-free community college. That is another thing that is, like Maggie was saying on the other issue, is popular not just among Democrats, but independents, that and even some Republicans. That is true for that. That is gone. And so there is, if you talk, that is sort of the feeling on the progressive side. If you talk to Joe Manchin, what he will say is, I went from zero on this social safety net proposal to at least $1.5 trillion. So he feels like he came up in a tremendous way. And he's right about that. So there has been compromise. But when you, this is what happens when you look at it, not just with numbers, but with real proposals. And when you start to see them fall away as the compromise starts to gel, that's when it becomes clear, you know, who's gotten what and who's given what.
Maggie, how will it reflect on President Biden and the country, for that matter, if this all falls apart right before the president's high-profile international trip? He's scheduled to go to Rome tomorrow for the G20 summit and then to Scotland for the climate summit.
I think actually too much is made, Wolf, of what this means for him as he goes on this foreign trip. I think that there are a number of concerns that foreign leaders have that don't relate to what is happening domestically in the U.S. But I do think that it would be helpful for this president, certainly as he's trying to convey a message and has been this whole year, of a different course for the country in the post-Donald Trump era, or at least the current post-Donald Trump era, despite the fact that Donald Trump has not really left the political scene, suggesting that that the country wanted to go in a different direction and that everything that Biden said about sort of a quote-unquote fever breaking, that at least some of that was true. That really hasn't proven true. And so I think to that end, it is frustrating to him. But I think, you know, more broadly, I think the concerns that he's going to face on this foreign trip are going to relate to alliances and relate to China's growing position in the world. And I think that's that the White House is aware of that. But I don't think this helps him, certainly.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And Dana, Democrats are also struggling right now with how to combat ongoing election lies. You have a brand new special airing later tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on CNN, entitled Stop the Vote, Stop the Vote, The Big Lies Assault on Democracy. I want to play a portion for our viewers. Watch this.
You understand how it looks from the outside in, that the Secretary of State, who prevented President Trump from meddling here, is now losing the power that he used to do just that.
His relationship with the president did not factor into my approach to this bill.
Do you believe that the 2020 election here in Georgia was free and fair?
I believe that a lot of Georgians have concerns that there were issues with it. And I believe that we as a legislature have a duty to respond to those people that had concerns.
So
this special report, specifically that exchange you had with the Georgia House Speaker.
Yeah, and you noticed there that he said that people who he represents and who his fellow Republican lawmakers in Georgia represent don't necessarily believe that the election was free or fair. He didn't say that he doesn't believe so. In fact, he believes, just like other Republican lawmakers in Georgia, in Texas, and in Arizona we spoke to, believe that Joe Biden is the duly elected president. But the pressure that they are feeling from Republican, from the Republican base, because of the lies that the former president continues to tell, that is helping to change and shape election laws that will have a real impact in the next elections starting next year.
Yeah, this is a really important special. Dana, thanks so much for doing it. And to our viewers, you can watch Dana's special report, Stop the Vote, The Big Lies Assault on Democracy. It airs later tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern, only here on CNN. Guys, thank you very much. Just ahead, the House committee investigating the Capitol insurrection sets its sights on a potentially key witness, the lawyer who tried to convince Vice President Mike Pence to overturn the presidential election. The lawyer who helped convince former President Trump he could reverse the 2020 presidential election results could be the next target of a subpoena from lawmakers investigating the January 6th insurrection. CNN's senior legal affairs correspondent Paula Reed has details.
Mr. Chairman, on this vote, The House Select Committee investigating the Capitol insurrection plans to subpoena John Eastman, a conservative law professor who tried to convince former Vice President Mike Pence to overturn the election.
I think he's a very pertinent witness.
A committee aide tells CNN that Eastman could still avoid a subpoena if he voluntarily cooperates with the committee's investigation. On Tuesday, Representative Jamie Raskin said the committee wants to know more about the pressure Pence faced.
We need to determine to what extent there was an organized effort against Vice President Pence, and we believe that some of the actors' names have become known, including John Eastman, who laid it out in a memo.
Eastman authored a two-page memo laying out what experts have called a nonsense legal theory for Republican officials to subvert the Constitution and throw out President Biden's victory when Congress convened to count Electoral College votes on January 6th. Eastman first tried to convince Pence of the plan to kick election results back to the states during a meeting with Trump in the Oval Office on January 4th. But Eastman didn't succeed. He tried again on January 6th.
And all we are demanding of Vice President Pence is this afternoon at 1 o'clock, he let the legislatures of the state look into this so we get to the bottom of it.
New video released Tuesday shows Eastman criticizing Pence for not following his plan.
Supporter to supporter, like, why do you think that Mike Pence didn't do it?
Well, because Mike Pence is an establishment guy at the end of the day. And all of the establishment Republicans in D.C. bought into this very myopic view that Trump was destroying the Republican Party.
The video was captured by Democratic activist Laura Windsor, who posed as a supporter of Eastman's to get him to talk.
And what Trump was doing is destroying the inside the Beltway Republican Party and reviving the Republican Party in the hinterland, right? What they all consider to be, you know, deplorable flyover country.
Just last week, Eastman told the National Review the strategy of having Pence reject the results was not viable and would have been crazy to pursue.
Mr. Eastman, in his public remarks, has been all over the map in terms of whether he stands by that memo, doesn't stand by that memo.
CNN has reached out to Mr. Eastman, but he has not responded to the video or the possibility of a subpoena. Now, the list of witnesses is growing by the day, but some interviews have been postponed, as have some records requests. Well, it appears the committee may be paring back the number of documents they're asking for, anticipating a lengthy court battle with former President Trump over executive privilege.
Yeah, they want to move relatively quickly as well. All right, thanks very much, Paul. Appreciate it very, very much. Paula Reed reporting. Let's get some more on this. Joining us now, CNN's senior legal analyst, the former U.S. attorney Preet Bharara, and CNN senior law enforcement analyst, the former deputy FBI director Andrew McCabe. He's also the author of the book, The Threat, How the FBI Protects America in the Age of Terror and Trump. Andrew, John Eastman was clearly influential in the fight to try to overturn the presidential election. What could he reveal to the Select Committee investigators?
Boy, Wolf, there are all kinds of details and facts that I would be interested as an investigator in getting from Mr. Eastman. He is someone who appeared at a number of different meetings or events that we know are instrumental to the attack that took place on January 6th. So he's in the war room. He's in the Oval Office meeting with the president and the vice president. He shows up at the rally and delivers a speech. So there are all kinds of very detailed facts that I'm sure the committee wants to get from Mr. Eastman. Who was he there with? What were they talking about? What sort of things did they agree upon? What sort of assignments may he have been given? All sorts of things like that.
Preet, would Eastman have any legal grounds to fight a subpoena if a subpoena comes forward?
Well, I don't think so. But remember that this is an individual who's associated with a former president for whom it doesn't matter if there's a viable or plausible legal basis to make an argument, whether it's a privilege or anything else related to the election. That said, I think the main basis on which Steve Bannon and others have said they don't want to come testify is executive privilege. This individual, John Eastman, was not part of the executive branch, not in the government at the time, so I don't think that flies. I suppose he can try and would make an argument of attorney-client privilege, but I think there's a powerful argument in response that that's been waived, depending on who else was in the room, how many other people the information and the communications were disseminated to. The memo is widely disseminated. We're talking about it on television. So I think that probably fails. And there also happens to be the case that even if you have a lawyer who is giving some portion of his communications qualifies attorney-client privilege, there's a whole hell of a lot of other stuff, including logistics on the day, things that were said publicly, things that don't relate to legal advice at all, that I think would be very illuminating, and he should be compelled to be able to testify about.
What did you make, Preet, of that video showing Eastman boasting about his role in all of this?
Well, I'm with Congressman Schiff on that. Eastman is all over the map. You have these people who didn't do the right thing, some of them with respect to the pandemic, some of them with respect to the 1-6 insurrection, and some of them are deciding to keep quiet and defend what they did. Some of them are deciding they need to distance themselves, and it sounds like Mr. Eastman is doing a little bit of both.
Interesting. And that video, is once again, was taken by a Democratic activist who posed as a Trump supporter, if you will. Andrew, the former president actually just wrote a letter to the editor in the Wall Street Journal, and they published it, spreading his big lie. He writes, among other things, he says this: well, actually, the election was rigged, which you, unfortunately, still haven't figured out. He's making it very clear his big lie isn't going away anytime soon. What does that say to you?
I think it says that it remains a very powerful political tool for the former president. He knows that the election wasn't stolen. He tried to steal it. He tried to do that with John Eastman and with others, and it didn't work. But it's still a very powerful rallying cry to the people who support him. He has managed to convince millions of Americans that that's the truth. It's incredibly sorrowful that he's gone out on that campaign. And now he's got a number of Republican elected representatives and senators and others kind of lining up behind him. So this is clearly the horse he's going to ride into the next series of elections.
Andrew McCabe, Preet Bharara, guys, thank you very much. Coming up, the man who handed Alec Baldwin the gun that killed a cinematographer makes a disturbing admission to authorities. Stand by for new details from a just-released search warrant. Tonight, we have new information about fatal mistakes made on the set of the movie Rust. The film's assistant director now acknowledging to authorities that he failed to fully check the gun he handed to the actor Alec Baldwin. CNN's Lucy Kavanaugh is in New Mexico covering the investigation.
The facts are clear. A weapon was handed to Mr. Baldwin. The weapon is functional and fired a live round, killing Ms. Hutchins and injuring Mr. Souza.
Tonight, as the Santa Fe County Sheriff reveals new details about what killed 42-year-old cinematographer Helena Hutchins and injured director Joel Souza.
This is the firearm we believe discharged the bullet.
A chilling admission from the man who handed Alec Baldwin that gun, Assistant Director Dave Halls, who told investigators he failed to fully check it. In a newly released search warrant, Halls told detectives, I checked the barrel for obstructions. Most of the time, there's no live fire. She, Hannah, opens the hatch and spins the drum, and I say cold gun on set. David advised when Hannah showed him the firearm before continuing rehearsal, he could only remember seeing three rounds. He advised he should have checked all of them, but didn't and couldn't recall if she spun the drum. Hannah Gutierrez was the armorer in charge of prop weapons. According to the search warrant, Gutierrez told investigators she handed the gun to Alec Baldwin a couple of times and also handed it to Dave Halls. When asked about live ammo, she responded, no live ammo is ever kept on set. The sheriff contradicted Gutierrez today, saying a suspected live round is what killed Hutchins and wounded Souza.
We suspect that there was other live rounds that were found on the set. I won't comment further on how they got there. I think there was some complacency on this set, and I think there are some safety issues that need to be addressed by the industry and possibly by the state of New Mexico.
The weapon used by Baldwin was the only working gun of the three seized by police from the movie set. Other items included 500 rounds of ammo.
That is a mix of blanks, dummy rounds, and what we are suspecting, live rounds.
How did a live round wind up in that gun? That is the question I want to know as a DA. Who's responsible for that? Did someone fail to do their job? That's where you're going to see potential criminal negligence.
A spokesperson for Rust Movie Productions tells CNN none of the film's producers have been contacted by the Santa Fe County DA, adding, we will continue to fully cooperate with any and all law enforcement investigations as they work through the details of this heartbreaking tragedy.
We don't know how those live rounds got there, and I think that that will probably end up being kind of the linchpin for whether a decision is made about charges.
No charges have been filed as the investigation continues.
So you heard the district attorney there. She told my colleague Josh Campbell that involuntary manslaughter charges could be considered in this case, pending the outcome of the investigation, although involuntary manslaughter cases are simply not common in the state of New Mexico. She also said that all options are on the table at this point, and no one has been ruled out just yet. Wolf.
All right, Lucy, thank you very much. Lucy Kavanaugh reporting. Let's bring in our CNN legal analyst, the criminal defense attorney Joey Jackson, along with CNN contributor and Entertainment Tonight co-host Nichelle Turner. Joey, this is significant new information we received today. The assistant director acknowledged he didn't properly check the rounds loaded into the weapon. Could we see charges stemming from that admission?
Well, if that's a stunning admission, and the answer is yes, we could very well see those charges. Why? The reality is that everyone has a duty and a responsibility to act reasonably, to act responsibly, to not act carelessly, particularly in circumstances such as this. There are internal protocols which provide for the safety of others, right? There's a chain of custody with respect to where that gun is. When it gets from one cabinet to another, to an actual set, did you look at it? Did you evaluate it? Is it your job to do so? And if it is your job and you fail to do that, then it rises and could rise to the level of criminality. Last point, Wolf, and that's this. When you look at the involuntary manslaughter statute, right, we know that there's nothing here that anyone did with intent as well as we could see at this point, right? Alec Baldwin certainly thought it was a cold gun, meaning didn't have a live round. But the statute, the law, speaks to whether you act in such a grossly unreasonable and careless way as to constitute a crime. And if this isn't gross carelessness, then we have to question what actually would be. And so, yes, this could potentially, if the DA went that way, district attorney, expose him to criminal liability.
Nichelle, is this admission from the assistant director the first public accountability we've seen in this case?
Yeah, I think so. We've heard, public apologies. We saw Alec Baldwin do that. We've seen statements by the production company. But in this, in their search warrant, what we saw there from the assistant director, yes, this is the first time that we've heard someone say, I did this. I did not check. We should have checked, and I don't know what happened. So, yes, like Joey said, that's a stunning admission. I also think hearing from the armorer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, saying we don't keep live ammunition on set, and then the authorities seizing two boxes of ammunition, 500 rounds, in which they believe there's actual live ammunition there, that's a huge contradiction. When I heard that, I said, why would anyone even say that? It's wild.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Where is this heading, Joey?
I think it heads to a further investigation. I think the sheriff will evaluate whether or not, with the district attorney, it rises to the level of a crime. And if it does, I think that's what we'll see. Obviously, we'll see internal protocols evaluated on this particular set, which, of course, it's on pause indefinitely. I think the movie industry itself will look at their protocols. And I would not be at all surprised, Wolf, if around the country you had state legislatures who were looking at activity around legislation to make this safer. So this it ends in a major place, but more microscopically, as it relates to this particular incident, I think a potential prosecution could very well be likely.
This is going to have a huge impact on the film industry, Nichelle, isn't it?
We've already seen some reverb from this, Wolf. We've seen it in the television space. The ABC drama The Rookie announced last week that they will no longer be using any sort of live guns or anything on their set. They just said any risk is too much risk and they just won't do it anymore. We've seen celebrities passing around a petition in order to take those things off of the set. Julianne Moore is one of the people spearheading that. So I do think that we're going to see more changes going forward in television and movies.
I suspect you're absolutely right, Nichelle Turner. Thank you, Joey Jackson. Thanks to you as well. Just ahead, an expert answers parents' questions about COVID-19 vaccines for younger children as health officials are getting closer and closer to authorizing shots for 28 million kids. We're awaiting the FDA's decision on whether to authorize the Pfizer vaccine for young children after it was endorsed by the agency's advisors yesterday. The CDC will weigh in next week, and shots could be in kids' arms as soon as early next week. Let's discuss with Dr. Ashish Jha, Dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. Dr. Jha, as usual, thanks for joining us. Now that kids, what, ages 5 to 11 could start getting vaccinated as soon as next Wednesday, a week from today, parents understandably still have a lot of questions. First, Some parents are concerned about the size of Pfizer's vaccine trial. There were 2,268 participants, ages 5 to 11. Is that enough data to demonstrate safety?
Yeah, good evening, Wolf. Thanks for having me here. That is very good amount of data, but also we have to remember it in a broader context. There have been 15 million kids ages 12 to 17 who've also gotten the vaccine. And while that's a slightly different group, their experience matters a lot as well. And so actually, we know a lot about these vaccines. They're the most tested and most carefully examined vaccines in the history of humanity. I think the 2,000 on the 5 to 11-year-olds really adds a lot to that. And I think gives me confidence as a dad of a 9-year-old that these vaccines are quite safe and very effective.
Many adults, as you know, experience the mild side effects after vaccination, including fever, body aches, or a sore arm. Do families need to be prepared for the kids, 5 to 11, to experience those types of side effects as well?
Yeah, they do. I mean, you know, again, we saw in the clinical trials about 20 to 30% of kids, so a minority, having kind of fevers, malaise, headaches, things that lasted about 24 hours. So, you know, I wouldn't give it to an 11-year-old before a big test the next day. I'd probably just span it out in a day that if they have a day where they're kind of miserable, that they can be at home, get better, and then it lasts about 24 hours and gets better.
If a child already had or recovered from coronavirus, so should that child still get the COVID-19 vaccine?
You know, it's a very good question. What we know about people with infections is that you get very high levels of protection for about 3 months. 3 to 6 months, it begins to wane. So I think if the child recently had an infection, it's reasonable to wait. If that infection was 9-12 months ago, we just don't know how good that natural immunity is anymore. And I would go ahead and vaccinate that child.
Just to be on the side of caution, some parents are wondering if their children will still need to wear masks in schools and elsewhere once they're vaccinated. What do you think?
Yeah, I see as kids get vaccinated and as vaccination numbers go up in those kids, infection numbers come down, I do see the masks coming off. You know, we're not going to want to have kids masked up forever. The real challenges with masking for long periods of time. But as soon as more and more kids get vaccinated, I absolutely see that school districts are going to start pulling those masks off. And I think that's pretty reasonable.
So you want your 9-year-old to get vaccinated, right?
Absolutely. And I've looked at the data very carefully as a dad. And for me, it's absolutely clear, Wolf, I think my son benefits from getting the vaccine.
All right, Dr. Ashish Jha, thank you very, very much. Coming up, anti-white supremacist protesters seek justice for the violence at the 2017 Charlottesville, Virginia, Unite the Right rally. We have details of the trial that's about to begin. Truly shocking scenes are about to be revisited in a trial seeking to hold some of the country's most notorious white supremacists accountable for the violence at their 2017 Charlottesville rally. CNN's Brian Todd is in Charlottesville for us. Brian, this is a civil trial, I understand, not a criminal trial.
It is indeed a civil trial, Wolf, a lawsuit seeking to make the organizers of that rally and others who took part pay a steep financial price. Tonight we have new information on the case and some of the key players in court. A horrific weekend of violence, which further exposed America's racial divisions.
This is our town now!
Tonight, people injured at the infamous Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, are seeking justice. The jury is now chosen, setting the stage for a civil trial to begin tomorrow, targeting the organizers of the 2017 gathering for white supremacists. The claim? That they knowingly planned for violence and should be held liable. With its Nazi slogans like blood and soil, a torchlight march the night before, and vicious battles in the streets, the rally shocked America with its brazen racism and anti-Semitism.
Jews will not replace us!
And the equivocation from then-President Trump poured fuel on the controversy, seemingly legitimizing the alt-right, white supremacists, and white nationalism in America.
You had some very bad people in that group, but you also had people that were very fine people on both sides.
Dozens were injured in street brawls. The violence culminated with a white nationalist, James Fields, plowing his car into a crowd of counter-protesters. One of them, 32-year-old paralegal Heather Heyer, was killed. Several others were injured. One of the 9 plaintiffs is Liz Sines, who says Fields' car almost hit her.
I will never forget watching them attack my fellow students or the feeling of running from my life.
Another plaintiff is Natalie Romero. The lawsuit says she was hit by Fields' car, causing a skull fracture and a concussion. And Marcus Martin, seen here in midair, who said his leg was broken and he couldn't work for 9 months. The lawsuit says social media posts and imagery by organizers suggested violence. Discussions in their chat rooms of bringing guns, quote, cracking skulls, even running over protesters.
The lawsuit is replete with example after example after example of how these defendants and their co-conspirators intended to commit violence. Comments like next stop Charlottesville, final stop Auschwitz.
But the defendants, who include some of America's most notorious white supremacists, have several potential arguments against liability. That free speech is protected, that they are not responsible for the actions of others, and that the police failed to keep order. To win a court judgment under the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871, the plaintiffs have to prove there was a conspiracy to engage in racially motivated violence.
It's a demanding standard, but there's an enormous amount of evidence. The plaintiffs are going to put on a quite lengthy case with lots of testimony and lots of evidence, especially from online discussions that anticipated the Unite the Right rally.
The plaintiffs say one of their goals is to bankrupt white supremacist organizations and members. Even before this trial began, at least one defendant claimed that he was financially crippled. Richard Spencer, a white nationalist alt-right leader who is representing himself in this case without a lawyer. Wolf?
All right, Brian, thanks very much. Brian Todd in Charlottesville for us. Coming up, a closer look at what's at stake as President Biden heads overseas tomorrow morning at a truly critical moment for his domestic and international agenda. President Biden is about to set off on a high-stakes international trip amid tension with some key U.S. allies and his domestic agenda right now on the brink. Let's bring in our CNN international diplomatic editor, Nick Robertson. He's already in Rome for us. President leaving the United States tomorrow morning for Rome. What's at stake? Set the scene for us, Nick, on the Biden visit.
Yeah, think of it this way, if you like, Wolf. Earlier this year, when President Biden made his big first foreign policy moves to summits in the summer, the G7, and then onto Geneva in Switzerland, it was really the message: I am President Biden. I am the reset for former President Trump. But now his message really has to be for his allies: I'm President Biden, and I'm coming with the reset for the foreign policy problems I had over the summer. I'm talking here, of course, about the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan, which didn't please many of the allies he'll meet here. And also the diplomatic rift he opened up with France by striking a nuclear submarine deal with Australia and the UK, replacing and removing France from a submarine deal with Australia. He will meet President Emmanuel Macron of France, so there will be a chance to sort of patch up that diplomatic rift. But remember, again, when the leaders are all in a room on Saturday, it will be Boris Johnson, Scott Morrison, and President Biden all in the room with Emmanuel Macron. That too could be awkward. People who won't be in the room: President Xi of China, President Putin of Russia, they're staying at home because of COVID problems there. So perhaps that eases tensions a little bit. President Biden will have a meeting with Pope Francis. They're likely to see eye to eye on a lot of issues, so that will be a good meeting likely for President Biden. They see eye to eye on climate issues, on income equality, on migration. So that's a positive for President Biden, but he's really got to make up a lot of ground. And the one way he might have been able to do that would be to come with some strong climate commitments. But absent his big spending agreement at the moment back home, that's going to be difficult for him to sort of set a global standard leading. So there's a lot to achieve here and a lot at stake, Wolf.
It certainly is. And Nick Robertson in Rome for us, thank you very much. And to our viewers, thanks for watching. Aaron Burnett Out Front starts right now.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.